Because this...
I would much rather take your straight idea of a straight thing. Why cannot we accept Russian flyers over here? I'd rather talk about that direct without this contradictory supporting evidence.
In what?
Why not?
First of all, you said
why not in a good in a well-developed Russian plane and leave the flying saucers out of it completely, leave all the mysticism about the marvelous inventions that the Germans had at the end of the war, which is why they won the war, and a few things like that out of it completely.
No, the very point that I want to make is I'm interested, and I only got into this thing from the other end, starting way back in history, to find out why people say there were things in the sky that didn't explain. What are they? All right, then we worked off all the other things, and then all of a sudden, we end up with the idea that some could be made on this earth. Why does everybody continue to say that they're lenticular in shape? That's the point that gets me. All right,
why are goats always white? Are they all colorblind?
Not all.
Most of them. They aren't. All the flying saucers aren't lenticular either.
Look, you don't know very much about flying saucer business, I can see.
They're not all lenticular.
Sure. What?
Oh, goats. The dress of black.
Well, I'm not. Wait a minute. I haven't met too many of them recently.
Let's leave the contactors out of it. Let's come to a couple of films, for instance, I've seen. Actually, both of them alleged. I mean, I don't know whether they could have been faked. Sure. But I want to know. They were blue with a little sort of aura of red around them.
These are the flying saucers, right? Not the bullets.
No, keep on the ball for a moment. Things in the sky, unexplained. During the war, I saw so many that we were told to stop reporting them. We didn't know what the diggings they were over down the ocean charge down in the Caribbean. Those were all bright for the peacock green, but they have belied I don't know what. They're pretty strange-looking objects, and the films of these things that I've seen have never been white. I have been told by person.
Now, wait, I didn't say that all flying saucers were white. I said that all ghosts were white, all flying saucers.
Ben, do you want to read some of those telegrams?
The telegram a little gobbled, I think. It's addressed to Juan Joe.
That's possible.
Juan. Congratulations.
Big Joe's happiness exchange. Go ahead.
Congratulations, Ivan, on following up this story, but congratulations to Celestia on not buying it. Rocket-powered helicopter, my foot. Ask any plane designer what he thinks of that combination. It's signed Lex Nevin.
I would like to argue on that. It happened that one of our most successful one-man helicopters had an acided jet at the end of each vane, and it worked. And I was working at the place where it was built, and it was working beautifully. It didn't work very long, but it worked.
This is in New York City. Long John to Sanderson. Heard of Canadian attempting to develop jet-propelled saucers. Any success or new information? Signed, Theodore Greenstone.
Of course, it's kind.
That one has been going on and on, yes.
This is from Brooklyn, New York. Long John. Mr. Sanderson, in view of your statement regarding rocketry in Germany, isn't it a fact that the Russians developed rocket artillery which reduced von Paulus's army before Stalingrad in 1942? While the Germans at Panmunda were trying to get the first V-2 rockets off the ground, in which they were unsuccessful until 1944, signed Samuel Bunkin.
Let's just take that one up.
In 1934, A-2 flew 6,500 feet. In 1933-38, they were working on A-3 with a maximum range of 8 miles. And in 1942, they were already flying Z-2.
That is
the simple chronology of that. The Germans had gotten the very satisfactory A-2 to work part of the time.
Had the gentleman who sent that last telegram, referring to two quite separate matters, as you know. The A weapon.
He said until 1944, the first Z-2 rocket.
He tried to imply that the Russians had rockets.
Russians certainly had rockets. They were entirely different types of rockets.
Yes, that's what I mean.
We also had rockets. Actually, our bazooka, for instance, was before the one in Stalingrad.
We had rockets in the Civil War.
The Greeks had rockets. Rockets, red glare, while appropriate today, nevertheless, originally referred to the War of 1812 when they were being used.
Exactly and precisely. In other words, this gentleman here is trying to imply that the Germans were behind the Russians. The Russians had one kind of rocket.
That the Russians actually had tactical rocket weapons.
The Russians themselves state that in 1933, the first Soviet
rocket driven by liquid fuel was launched.
Quite possible. In 1931, the first German one was launched, and in 1926 or thereabouts, Goddard flew our first rocket fuel.
Yeah, and what happened, what actually did happen in Russia? Are you ready, Jim, to take the second part?
Jim Runyon?
Or would you tell us?
Do you want to tell us, sir?
Yes.
All right, fine.
I understand. On wood.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial.
My translator, Jim, helped me.
All right, Jim. Do you want to turn that mic around so that it'll be paid? No, let him use this one because you stay on your own mic,
right.
Ivan, please. Jim Runyon, would you mind coming in just a little closer, please? Thank you. And try to... I know that you have a statement there. Do you want to read that and try to stay on mic?
All right. Fine. This is the second person that Mr. Zavalishin would like to describe. That is, rather, the experience that he had in, when he met him. It was a lieutenant of the Smersha. That means death to the spies at the special section of the NKVD. And he spoke of a group of Soviet and German engineers who in South Russia are working on a boomerang rocket. This rocket is actually... rocket is actually to return to the very spot from which it is launched. But unlike the engineer from Degendorf, it was difficult to believe this, MVD lieutenant. This conversation took place in 1951. But in 1955, in the Soviet journal Around the World, a science fiction story appeared written by Maciej Yunus. The name of this story was The Screen of Life. In this story, one is reminded of the existence of the very same kind of boomerang rocket that the MVD lieutenant described. And a year ago, the well-known scientist and academician Fyodorov, the author of a series of scientific works concerning research of the higher layers of the atmosphere with the help of rockets and Sputnik, with the help of rockets and Sputnik, he said that he hopes that very soon the boomerang rocket will no longer be just a theory but a reality. All of these things support the ideas of Sanderson. I haven't enough time to describe in detail everything that he said. There's an interesting remark of Marshal Zhukov that Mr. Zavalishin has quoted. Marshal Zhukov loved to repeat that cannons are not made to work without shells just for the purpose of placing them in historical museums. Speaking of the history of rockets, Sanderson, having started with ancient China, but after the war, the Russians took the German V-1 and V-2 rockets in their own hands. Sanderson doesn't speak about the role of the Russians in the history of rocket development. The revolutionary Kabalchich prepared with his own hands the bomb that killed Tsar Alexander II. After he was jailed for this murder, he drew sketches of rocket plans, or rather, rocket planes, on walls of his cell. Not only was this a rocket that he drew, but it was somewhat like the German V-1. That isn't fiction of communist propaganda. It is a well-documented and objectively established fact. The thought of Kibalchich preceded reality by more than 70 years. Imagine if Napoleon had been able to avail himself of rocket weapons research. Would it mean that he would have been able to have atomic weapons from a practical point of view? Well, of course not, because of technical development of civilization. The same thing has been the case in regard to Kabalchich. Professor Obert, teacher of Werner von Braun, recognized Tsiolkovsky as the founder of the science of modern rocketry. As far back as 1903, Tsiolkovsky published a work handling the exploration of space by means of rocket instruments. In 1929, Tsiolkovsky published a scientific paper about space rocket trains. In this paper, I'm sorry, about trains of rockets. In this paper, he presented a scheme for a multi-stage rocket device. By means of such a device, both the Soviet and American satellites were launched into space. In the West, Joukowsky is not well known. Even less is known about his students and followers who worked on rocket development for military purposes. For example, during the First World War, a famous sports car racer and flying ace named Utyushkin tried to persuade the Russian defense minister, Sukhomlinov, to allocate means for the production of rocket bombs that had a remote resemblance to the German V-1. Sukhomlinov packed Utyushkin directly off to the crazy house. Those followers of Joukowsky, who invented the famous rocket launcher known as the Katyusha, had more luck, however. As is known, during the Second World War, the Katyusha weapon aroused surprise and curiosity as well as jealousy. But it was developed and produced without any help whatsoever from the Germans. This doesn't mean that I agree on all points with Mr. Sanderson. When he says that the Russians captured German military secrets and weapons, I believe this is true. But I would like to remind you that one should not... one should not disregard the inborn Russian talent and the latitude of the Russian's imagination. Here it is interesting to remember the words of the Russian writer Alexander Green, which expressed in 1915 in his novel Gunner from Azerbaijan and discussed in the magazine Neva. The tragedy of our science lies in the fact that there is a cleft between scientific imagination and its practical application. The strength of German science, however, lies in the unity of imagination and practical experience. In the case of our victory over Germany, there may appear the union of German and Russian sciences. Besides opening the sluices for irresistible fantasies, these fantasies will materialize. That is what the Russian writer Alexander Green said in 1915. These words sound prophetic. That which didn't occur during the First World War did during the Second. Let us admit that the union of Russian and German scientists was established in a barbaric way through violent force. But bold Russian fantasies, with the help of the Germans, were actually put into practice. And that explains a lot. Psychologically, there is much in common between the Hitler and Soviet regimes, but you cannot compare the situation of the scientists in both of these totalitarian states. With Hitler, there was a romantic spirit which inspired both scientists and soldiers. But with the communists, that spirit has been missing for a long, long time. Let us recall Welles's The First People on the Moon. In this novel, the Selenites are inhabitants of the moon, are raised in containers which limit their size. Only these creatures' feelers are permitted to grow out of the containers, and only those feelers that are useful to the collective. Russian scientists may be compared with these moon dwellers.
Ivan?
Well, I was going to say something serious, but in the meantime, Sven passed a note to me saying he is a fantastic universe in himself. Meaning you, John.
Well, thank you very much.
I think it's one of the best compliments I've ever heard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ullman. Thank you, sir. I also had one from Lester.
Yes?
He said a little... You know, I've been trying to get him on for a long while. And everybody tells me Del Rey will never come on. He wants no part of these weird things that you talk about. But at least he said, you're a good pitchman.
Thank you. John, I'd like to bring up a subject that Sven can tell you something about. Long, long before anybody ever heard of a flying saucer in the United States of America, the Swedish people were much concerned by things called ghost planes. And take it up from there, William. Just,
Well, the parallel is perhaps not very close, Ivan, but there is one curious thing about it that I think perhaps has some relevance or could make one reflect a bit when discussing this question. Could there be such a thing? Is there such a thing? And it is this. One often hears the suggestion that it is nothing but an optical phenomenon and some weird kind of refraction in various layers of the atmosphere. I don't know technically how it is being explained, but certainly you will agree that there are these attempts at explanations given. They may be right, I don't know. But the parallel that occurred to me has to do with these ghost planes that I'm amazed that you're informed about. Before the war, when there was no such thing as radar, and observations, therefore, were that much more difficult, a somewhat disquieting thing started happening in the northern part of Sweden, in Lapland, where very few people live, but which is an important part, and also, if you think in strategical terms, you might say a vital area. Strange light phenomena were seen there. One didn't know what it was. It seemed as though it was some kind, or at least some people suggested this might be some very high-flying aeroplanes. And gradually this thing began to be called the phantom planes, or the ghost planes, if I translate it into English. And every now and then there would be a dispatch in the papers. Now, another observation had been made of such a ghost plane. And there were the weirdest theories about it, including, and that is what makes me think of this as a somewhat of a parallel of the discussion with these UFOs, including the suggestion that it was just some kind of light, of optical phenomenon with a natural explanation. I remember, now we know, I should say this, preface it by this again. Later it did become quite clear that this was a kind of air reconnaissance of the northern areas of the Scandinavian Peninsula, I believe by Russian planes, but I wouldn't be held to that if it was that exclusively. Anyway, a very curious episode occurs to me in this connection. I was working at that time on a newspaper in Stockholm, and one evening, very late, one of these dispatches came in about that now they'd been at it again. We did not know that these were planes, mind you, at that time. I'm saying that we know now. Another one of these dispatches came in, the ghost plane size again. And the man who was to do this story wanted to send for some clippings in the morgue of the paper to see what had been written before and try to coordinate what he had with what had been happening before as to locations and so on. And it turned out the man who minded the morgue had already gone home, and he had to send a copy boy up who was not very well versed in the card index up there in the attic somewhere. And this boy came back and said he couldn't find it. There is nothing about ghost flyers. Well, they had to make do without the clippings that evening. But the next day, some very searching questions were being asked of the man who was responsible for the morgue. And he was asked, "What is this? Have you never saved any clippings about the ghost planes?" And he became very indignant and said, "Of course I have. They're all under Aurora Borealis." What had happened was that the first reports of this had simply been reports of a light phenomenon believed to be some new kind of Aurora Borealis. And then automatically everything that came in, and this has been going on, I think, for a year or two, had been shoved into the same envelope with the Aurora Borealis stuff. And there it was, and the man who ran it normally, of course, knew that by this time it was exactly as when a housewife in the kitchen keeps her salt in something that says flour and her coffee where it says tea. It's just a different kind of orderliness. This has nothing much to do with what we're talking about, except for the parallel between, the possible parallel, I should say. I will not vouch for any, the existence of any sources on the strength of this. I would just point to the possibility that things are being interpreted in one way. As long as you don't know what they are, there is no end to the interpretations they can get. And the fact that one interpretation is made does not mean that not another may not be the right one.
You need a good IBM filing system.
Sven. Oh, do you know Sven, do you know anything about the reported Swedish government interest in the subject of UFOs that, according to some UFO researchers here, extends back for the past 30, 40 years or so?
No, I'm afraid I cannot elucidate you on that, and I think that official statements of public admissions to that effect exist. Are there any official admissions as to the interest of the American authorities?
Ivan?
I'm so sorry, I wasn't attending.
I think, in all fairness to Ivan, we received a telegram here with a special message.
Yeah.
It's a personal telegram to Ivan, and that's why for a moment he was concentrating on the telegram rather than to our conversation. Do you want to repeat that again, please?
Do you know anything about this? You remember the frequent references to Swedish government interest in UFOs?
Well, not called UFOs, but I understand from a friend of mine that I was at school with in Sweden, that subsequently in the Swedish Foreign Office, that there had been a lot of peculiar things reported throughout the ages in the sky over Sweden, which of course were not called UFOs or flying saucers or anything of that nature in those days, going way back. And that the Swedish Foreign Office had become considerably distressed about this long before the First World War, and wondered what these things were, particularly types of mirages, which were said to be inexplicable, showing all kinds of things very clearly over Stockholm. They are recorded in your newspaper, and I can't pronounce it myself. And that the
Dagens Nyheter.
I can say that.
I'm sorry, I was born at that time, but I was not with the Dagens Nyheter. I'm afraid I've never heard of this.
Well, there are two countries in the world where there have been fuss amongst the public and amongst newspaper people, and even with the government, about things in the sky never seen before.
There's a suggestion from an erudite gentleman at my right that these may have been Valkyries.
Well, indeed, in truth. Where did that...
Sweden?
Why not?
Certainly.
Well, they slip over the mountains occasionally.
They didn't confine themselves only to Norway. That's what they did.
I was wondering if, for a moment, maybe we can spend 5 or 6 minutes on this idea. Some time ago, I had the pleasure of talking with Ivan on the party line, and we were discussing flying saucers, not in the same manner as we are this morning. We were talking about the people who claim that they have had contacts with Venusians, Martians, and what have you, and people forgetting about the people who claim that they've been there. But I was just wondering if you have an opinion on this, Lester, in that... Not about... I know that you have some very definite opinions, but if you'll let me present this first.
We're on the air, Lester.
I have had a lot of people on the program who told us about experiences of meeting Venusians and Martians. I'm not talking about making trips to the other planets, but that these unusual craft arrived in their backyards. And I was just wondering, and I kicked this around with Ivan one morning, and in fact, Ben Gross, the dean of radio and TV editors of the New York Daily News and the Sunday News, wrote an entire column about this. My thought is this.
Is there a possibility that the Russians have a craft that is saucer-shaped that may be arriving in the States here, may be landing in farms and also in apple orchards and what have you, and that there's a possibility that these people, our citizens who greet the occupants of these strange-appearing crafts, that they are so sold on these people who get out of the craft that they believe that maybe they may be coming from other planets. In other words, is there a possibility that the Russian government may be sending people to this country claiming that they're Martians and Venusians in order to gain the confidence of the Howard Mengers, the George Van Tassels, the Dan Frys, and people of that type? What do you think about that, Lester Del Rey?
I can't categorically say it's impossible that the Russians could land here. On the other hand, my first question of that is, to what end? You must realize that any spy activity or any propaganda activity, which is as expensive as that, necessarily has to return value received, value paid to the country doing it. It seems to me that in the first place, if they were going to do that, they would soon find out that the only people they could contact that way are people who, at least in my opinion, and in the opinion of a great many other people, are crackpots. And if those crackpots are not very influential on the public body at large. The second thing, if they were capable of acting as angels from above and so on, putting on this wonderful act, bringing this wonderful message and so on, why the heck didn't they do it in Hungary where they needed it, instead of in the United States where they don't immediately need it? They could have done it in countries nearer them where it was very much more needed for their own propaganda purposes. And we don't hear many accounts of flying saucers landing in Hungary and talking to the peasants. In fact, that country...
How would we know?
We have heard of a number of accounts of flying saucer sightings in Russia. This is not unusual there. I am sure that...
Interplanetary craft?
Now I've got myself... I've got myself into a situation where I'm going to have to try it. Mr. Savalishkin.
Savalishkin.
All right. can tell you... Well, at least that makes it even. I can tell you more about that than I can. It does seem that an awful waste of a tremendous expense for very little result.
But if they wanted to land in Hungary, they'd just take a train
It didn't work very well that way. Wouldn't goodwill do them some good in Hungary? Not after the war over there, but before.
I don't think you...
I think that's a very invalid argument.
I don't think that Lester...
I think the whole thing is invalid. I think, in other words, that it has no propaganda value. And if it did have propaganda value, they would have used it in their own shaky territory, too.
This is not my idea at all.
No.
My theory is just this.
WOR Radio, 710 on the dial in New York.
The only word that I can think of at the moment.
Credulous.
If we can get a man... Well, let's say 10 or 15 people in New Jersey, 10 or 15 people in all states, in the 48 states of the Union. If we can get these people to believe, if they're gullible enough to believe that the occupants of these of this unusual craft that may be landing in their apple orchards or on their farmland, if they believe that these occupants are coming here to do us good, that they're Venusians and Martians, then, if they happen to be Russians, they can gain the confidence of these people. And should there ever be a time, if the time ever arrives that they need help, they will have 1,000, 2,000, maybe 5,000 people ready at the drop of a hat to help.
I wonder what those 5,000 people could do. I am looking at the people that they have got. Generally, I don't think those are effective people. They could, at most, paralyze a few localities which have very little military value. The next war is not going to be fought that way. It won't be a slow infiltration. It will have to be a fast one.
And I'm sure that the Russians are very aware of that. Of course, you've got to remember that I am moderating some of my statements now, and some of my arguments are not easily presented over the air without a good deal of thought as to how they can be made both low pressure and cogent. Because this whole subject of the contact cases leaves me somewhat irate. But I think that the average contact case would make about the poorest agent that the Russian government could have. Let me put it that way as best I can. And I also remember the YCL. Now, the YCL was a very friendly organization. It wasn't officially the Communist Party, but it was the Young Communist League. You would think that with a bunch of people very dedicated in many ways to the Russian idea, that the Russians would have taken every single pain in the world to protect their contact with the YCL. But they didn't. They were very sloppy in their relations with the YCL. They brushed them off time after time after time. They didn't seem to regard them as of sufficient importance. So I wonder why they would regard these people who would believe an angel from above or from Mars and Venus as being so important.
Lester, the experience that I've had talking with some of these people leads me to believe that they would follow any instruction that a Venusian or a Martian may give them. Now, here's just a thought. I think I heard it on some of the newscasts, something about the Russian government receiving a letter from an American pilot. And this American pilot claimed that he was going to drop an atom bomb, I think, someplace. Did you hear this news?
No, this I haven't heard.
Is anybody here familiar? Am I correct?
Yes, Malik in London received a letter.
Oh. Yes. My idea is this. If a thing like this can stir up so much interest about the possibility of a pilot dropping a bomb to prove, this is the thought, this is what was incorporated in the letter, this idea, that if he drop a bomb, he may prove to people that the atom bomb is very dangerous. I don't know why he should want to prove that. We know that. It's obvious to everybody at this time. But this pilot, according to his letter, he was trying to say that the American people would then realize that the Russian government is on the right track. Wasn't that the basic idea of this?
Yes.
Now, I feel, after talking to some of these people who claim that they've had contacts with Venusians and Martians, that they would do anything to help not the Russians, but the Venusians and the Martians. Now, the Venusians and the Martians are here to do us only good. I mean, if we believe the story. Don't you think that it would be shocking to the American citizens if an announcement came from Russia that at 3:30 on Tuesday afternoon in the middle of such and such month that a section of a railroad terminal would be blown up? Now, my thought is this. That if there are Russians landing here in this strange-appearing craft, in these so-called flying saucers, and they're able to reach enough gullible people who believe that they are not Russians, but that they're Martians or that they're from some other planet, and then these same alleged Martians tell these gullible people to take this package, which contains the message, or contains the books, which you're going to distribute in 2 or 3 months from now, put it in locker number 17 in such and such terminal. This could be done in New York, in Kansas City, in Newark, New Jersey, in Chicago. Then the Russian government would announce not about Martians or Venusians. They would merely say that at 3:30 on such and such afternoon, to show you our power, you will find that a small section of railroad terminals in various parts of the United States of America will be blown up.
Well, look, in the first place, John, if I could accept the flying saucers...
I don't accept them either.
If I could accept any of these contacts had any substance,
I might say then that this theory is far more logical than most of the others, far more logical because at least it does present some motive, which is more than most of the others do. It also at least indicates a tangible source on Earth from which they come, and that much at least I'll go along with Ivan in preference to this Mars and Venus and all that nonsense. But since I cannot accept the possibility of the contacts having any necessary substance behind them at all, after all, I remember the, and I'm going to say here, the other science fiction crackpot phrases, because flying saucers to too much of an extent got into the whole business through science fiction, too. I remember the Darrow craze in Ray Palmer's magazine, and I remember all the people who reported the Darrows. Well, I am quite sure that there were no Darrows, and even the Russians can't explain that. I remember also the people who went out and got cured when Ron Hubbard discovered Dianetics. And incidentally, I heard from somewhere that Ron Hubbard is perhaps one of the space people kicking around. This is only... I don't think so. I think his president...
That's his son.
It's his son? That might be interesting. I thought that his own...
That's an unfortunate statement that naturally kicks around a rumor. It's rather unfortunate.
Well, I didn't really believe that it was Ron Hubbard anyway. But, I would rather believe any fantastic thing like that than to believe even that the Russians took this thing seriously. And if, I don't really think they do. I think that if they did, the United States government would take that possibility into consideration also and keep a careful check on these saucer people. And the check apparently is not that serious.
You had something to add, Hans?
Yes, I want to throw one thing into the hamper. And incidentally, John, I've been noticing Brother Savalchin looking very unhappy here, and looks like he wanted to add something too. I want to quote a statement by one of these gentlemen, and obviously I don't want to identify him. I think you'll understand my reluctance to do so over the air. But this particular person says in the course of a public statement, "This is the avenue of approach to eliminate the false nuclear program, which is continually poisoning our waters and atmosphere 12 years after the entrance of the atomic age, and is pronounced an unsolved problem of fantastic proportions. Rather than destroy matter and nature with destructive forces, man can begin to utilize the creative energies exhibited by the spaceships in our atmosphere and between the planets." I submit, Lester, that this has a familiar tinge.
I'd like to add just that, is that from a few of the contact people who have been on this program, is that every time you mention rocketry or something, this is poo-pooed as a vulgar, brutal way for space travel or for... And that you're going to have, you know, that there are various other much more subtle ways of utilizing the charges of the electrons and the atmosphere and all the rest of it. Yeah, but this is aside from this. I mean, if this was a concerted effort, I mean, I think John is gullible in thinking that these people are gullible. I don't think they're gullible, but and I apply everything that's implied there. I mean, but the point is that this is a concerted effort to poo-poo all interest in technical advances, such as, you know, rocketry, as if it's a vulgar, sort of pushy way of doing it.
Oh, well, I think you all missed the point, if I may say so.
I'm sorry to interrupt at this time, but we have a little business to take care of.
Editorial director of Fantastic Universe magazine is with us, Ben Iskowitz, Lester Del Rey, Ivan T. Sanderson, the eminent zoologist, and Ben Iskowitz, the cybernetician. And we have Jim Runyon with us, translator, and a gentleman who was formerly an officer in the Russian army and for a time a prisoner of war in Nazi Germany. He is now an American citizen, but certainly a very well-informed person on the matters that we're discussing this morning. And his name is...
Vyacheslav Zavalishin.
Good?
Very good.
Was he? He's wonderful. That's dead fire.
Real pronunciation.
We have been talking with these people about this article, Man-Made UFO. Now, this morning, in talking about flying saucers, we are not talking about the people that have been to Venus, Mars, the moon, or anything like that. This is a very, very serious discussion. This is not science fiction. That is the article that we're talking about. Possibly
Mr. Del Rey feels it's science fiction. But the author, Ivan T. Sanderson, would not agree with that. And remember...
Yes, I would.
You would?
Well, I want to ask Lester something. Is that you've been generally poo-pooing most of the ideas that Ivan has brought out in his article, and poo-pooing to me always seems to be sort of the wrong track to take, since I've been sort of conditioned not to regard any idea as too outlandish. Of course, some that I've heard I consider to be way, way out. But, for instance, I'm reminded of a very funny, which at that time did not seem particularly funny, incident that once happened to a friend of mine who was working on a classified project. There's a third friend who's pretty irresponsible in most of his actions, and he went to Mexico on a vacation. He thought it would be a great joke, especially since this friend who was working on classified material, his security clearance was coming up for renewal. So he sent him a nice little postcard from Mexico City saying, "Dear so-and-so, having a wonderful time, have absconded to Mexico with atomic secrets," and signed his name. Now, the FBI got very interested in this postcard, and it took a long time to explain the fact that this was a joke. And then they were pretty upset by the fact that, you know, since when is this a thing to joke about? Now, if they can get concerned about something which, after all, was nothing but a prank, why shouldn't they be concerned about the fact that there are rumors, there are stories, there are allegations, there are whisperings, there are murmurings that the Russians have developed a circular foil spacecraft that has the fantastic performances that have usually been associated with flying saucers, especially in view of the fact that sometime this year, the United States is going to fly, or try to fly for the first time, the X-15, which will be the first rocket ship ever put, or as far as we know, the first rocket ship put up by mankind, in that it is actually no longer a conventional aircraft. It's I think its short little stubby wings are about 3 feet long. It's just used to get it off the ground. And actually, in designing the plane, the engineers had a re-entry problem with it because its height is so fantastic. And for all practical purposes, it is a spaceship. Now, if this, according to what we think, is the furthermost advance mankind has ever reached in a rocket ship, this all becomes pretty laughable if the Russians already have ships that have performance characteristics of flying saucers. And this is something we should be very concerned about, whether or not it is true.
Well, I'm not... let me say that this is not the first rocket ship. It's the first rocket ship capable of rising to heights over 25 miles or so.
It's going to go into a region that we could very easily...
We could almost call
space.
Space.
Yeah.
Now, look, if I were Army intelligence, I would not poo-poo anything. If it were my business to examine all possibilities, no matter how remote, because even one remote one slipping through could endanger the country, then I would be on my toes, I think, just as the FBI has to examine even the most outlandish and fantastic kidnapping cases and things like that. They're supposed to, at least. And as a matter of fact, the absence of certain investigations in Pearl Harbor proved to be very fatal. And they were fantastic, and they had every reason for disregarding them from their point of view at the time. I think that there is too much of a tendency in official circles to poo-poo. But to a man who is essentially a professional dilettante, whose opinion is of no great vital importance to the country, these things are not so vitally important, and I have to restrict myself to accepting that which to me has enough evidence to make it worth accepting. In other words, I have to see how it will work, or why it will work, or why there is some good reason that I should accept it first. Now, this may sound strange from a science fiction writer, but if you don't do that, you can't write good science fiction. You're writing nothing but the most outlandish fantasy. It's a trained habit. The scientist has to have it, too. He cannot have a completely open mind. The minute he opens his mind completely, he does not have enough judgment left to pick those fields where the probabilities are high enough to justify the work on them. In other words, if you want to let's say, well, now anything is possible, and go dithering around, searching through every improbable but possible thing, you come up with so much wasted effort that you never get anywhere. Science automatically has to restrict itself.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, the very fact that once you make up your mind, if you had a completely open mind, no one would ever do anything because you'd always be considering the alternatives. So once you decide upon a course of action, for that moment, you have a closed mind, and this is not the... This is not, you know, the regrettable sounding thing it is. Sometimes it's very good to have a closed mind, but that is not exactly the point. If it is true the Russians have developed a saucer-like craft, especially in view of the fact that right after the war, everyone got so concerned about what was being taken out of Germany and all the rest of it, and that I think Ivan mentioned in his article something like German rocket secrets were being sold as army surplus for $1 a sheet or something. This is a fantastic bungle if this is true.
I believe they had been picked too, but very carelessly picked too first.
What I cannot understand is this. There was an agreement between the Russian allies and the what we now call the Western allies that we would divide up the spoils. Now, we both arrived at about the same time at certain points. And as I understand it, and I'm very sorry, but having been brought up on the other side, I rather respect this magazine flying, this RAF publication here. And it states that we both arrived at the same point at the same time. Now, presumably, the Germans had developed something which was worthwhile having, because after all, we didn't have a V-2, let's face it, they did. I was on the receiving end, you weren't over here. The thing worked, badly, but it worked. I would have imagined that if we got there, we'd want to try and find out what was going on. What I cannot understand is this, why these things were given to our allies, our eastern allies, the Russians, and why we didn't get them first. Here in this paper, it states categorically that Werner von Braun, now our biggest hope, was left lying around for 3 or 4 months there. Nobody even had the intelligence to ask him a question. I can quote from here. I've been reading it during the coffee break. To me, it's absolutely horrifying. I simply want to know if anybody does know what was going on, what they really did find, not just these little statements in these magazines, official or otherwise, and where the things went to, and if they had got to the point that these magazines state that the Germans had got to. Do you follow me?
No.
Have we, both of us, east and west, sat on our hands and done nothing further? Here we have from the gentleman on our left here, who was in the Russian army, the statement, the statement was read before, that the Russians had been developing rocketry and had thoughts about them from way back to 1909, 1915. They were thinking the way we were, the Germans were thinking, and on this side, we were lagged behind. Goddard did many great things. Wait a minute, let me finish. Excuse me. I cannot understand. I want to know what actually did go on. And why did they suddenly stop? If they'd got that far, is it a complete blank, so nothing has happened any further than that? Nothing seems to have happened very much here. We're still using parts, I understand, of this A4, or V2, to get our explorers into the air. I am not, as I say, an engineer, and I don't really understand very much except what I read, just like any ordinary person in the paper. I'm speaking for the ordinary person tonight. Have the Russians not proceeded? And if the Germans had got as far as these papers say they had at the end of the war, and they did, the Russians did get this stuff, somebody gave it to them, let them take it, have they just simply sat on their hands and done nothing since then? My goodness, if the Germans could bomb in 1945, they could bomb from Germany to London, which indeed they did with their V2s. Where's the time lag? Why haven't the people who took over all these great inventions and the scientists, as everybody I think admits, both of us did on both sides, have they developed nothing in that time?
Lester? Well, now I'm going to stop poo-pooing because I agree 100% with Ivan and many of the things he says. And this is a serious problem. As to von Braun, I think that the answer is that he was picked up by the military, and he was a civilian. Our military men, just as the German military men would have done had the situation been reversed, seemed to think that the important man was the military man. It was Dornberger, I believe.
Yeah.
And they paid almost no attention to civilians. Uh-huh. And they treated him with a good deal of contempt, because obviously the man at the head of this would be a military man. And his casual statement that he might have had something to do with it wouldn't interest them. There was a great deal of just plain muddle-headedness.
Well, I'll tell you something else. If you'd pardon my nipping in here, and I'm going to get rather angry on this subject, not with you personally or with anybody else personally, but I do happen to know, I don't know whether the American intelligence did, but the British intelligence knew who were the persons, civilian or otherwise, who were running the rocket project in Germany. I know they know that. because I was in that service in a very, very minor capacity, right on the thin end. And if I knew it, and certain the people in the middle knew it, the people they should have gone to first of all, whether they did or whether they didn't, I do not know. But according to this article, again I refer to it, this RAF article, they did go to them, asked some questions, and they went away and left the whole thing. And they went back again. Now, I'm not arguing with that. There's a muddle at the end of a war. I've seen the end of a war, and you have. And it's a colossal muddle. But the point I'm trying to make is this, and I'm sorry to drag this awful flying saucer business in, this UFO business, in again. Throughout the ages, people have said they've seen things in the sky. But starting in 1947, 2 years after the war, there were certain professional flyers who said, we have seen some things in the sky. They're ready to do alarm us because they look like planes. And then constantly it is reported or rumored that such type of aeroform, and let's cut out the circular ones, just simply say advanced planes. Because after all, there was a time when people were told that there were angels in the sky. And by George, they saw a meteorite and they said they were. I mean, people can convince themselves of what they have been told they expect to see in the sky, they're going to see. All right, now these combatant flyers, 2 years after the termination of the war, said they had seen things in the sky. In fact, Kenneth Arnold, I don't know if you know this, John, was sent out amongst other as professional flyers to search for a plane, an official plane, which had been downed near Mount Rainier, allegedly containing some very important persons. I have asked people who want to know who were those important persons, and they all smile and say, well, yeah, we've heard that too, but we never were able to get the answer. But
what does Kenneth Arnold say about it?
Well, you had him on the... No, you, didn't you
well,
have him on the program?
No, I had him on the Beaver phone.
He has simply said that he was asked as a... as a competent pilot, individual out there, to go out and help search for a government plane that had been downed. And when he was searching for it, they saw, according to his story, a number of strange objects which looked like planes but seemed to behave very much better than any plane that we had at that time. All I'm asking is... what is all this about? And you gentlemen around this table know a great deal more about it than I do. You may be able to contribute something to it. I think it's about time that somebody made a statement saying either categorically the Germans did not develop these various weapons, did not have these other weapons or satellite-type things and so on their drafting boards, or they did. And if they did, how many went to Russia and how many came here? And thirdly, what have we done with those that we got? And what do we know about what the Russians have done with what they got?
Ivan, let me ask you one question in reference to the article in the book, Man-Made UFO, in Fantastic Universe Science Fiction. What is this story about the plan being sold by our government as war surplus for a dollar per sheet or a dollar per plan?
John, you're a publicist. In this article... I stated categorically that according to a small mimeographed job put out by a man called Jim Mosley, whose name you know.
We've had him on the...
You've had him on the air, you know. He's interested in strange things. And that I simply quoted from him, and I stated in there that I was so quoting from him. And he, in turn, was quoting from... I haven't got my right glasses on. Stefan, read it for me. Would you?
He was quoting from some chapters in a book, Bien en los Platillos Volantes, The Coming of the Saucers, written in Spanish by Enrique Miguel Borges. These particular chapters of the book were written by Ulbricht von Rittner, a former officer in the Special Technical Services of the German Army. Borges is of the opinion that the origin of saucers is still a mystery, but he turned over some chapters of this book to von Rittner, who believes in a terrestrial solution. It is a mild understatement. In all fairness to Jim Mosley, who has appeared on this program and whom we, some of us at least, know, and who published the issue of Saucer News where this translation appeared, I think we should add, however, that Mosley continued in his preface to say this: we do not believe that the story you are about to read is true in every detail, but von Rittner does give you some very important information that has not previously been published in this country.
You see, John, what I was trying to do in this article was to put together, and I think I make that quite clear in several paragraphs, they may be rumors, but they are published statements. And if they're lies, somebody in authority or not in authority should get up and say so. And if they get up and say so, they should say why so. I've simply tried to put together as many of these facts as I could. Now, I do not feel that this magazine here, this RAF magazine for July, Flying, is going to lie. And some of the things they say in here coincide very closely with what my engineer told me. And what Mosley says, and what this Swedish publication takes from the ex-NKVD...
But Mosley has a preface to the article, doesn't he? Where he makes the statement that...
He doesn't think all the facts in here are true, but he is...
So, in other words, he gives you the entire article. He tells you that all of the facts are not true, but he doesn't tell you which ones are true or untrue.
John, now you're quibbling. If you pardon me...
I don't want to quibble.
Well, listen a moment. He states in here, I am going to now print, in quotes, which he does, certain sections from a book. We, editorial, do not believe that all the statements in this are true. We don't know. He doesn't know any more than I do. And I went to long pains to explain in the article in this magazine, Fantastic Universe, that I was quoting from him. But I'm not trying to bring evidence for anything. I'm simply trying to put together, John, statements that had been made and published by a large number of different people. And they have been made, and they keep on cropping up. They've been cropping up since the end of the war. And they have not a ring of truth, but they have the same thread running all the way through. You can go back and say that there's been a thread running, the same thread running through ghosts, for instance, for years and years and years. All right, but this is a much more serious subject. I mean, we do have planes that do certain things. And what this type of flying saucer, not all UFOs, please, but some kinds which flyers say they're worried about. They don't worry about crackpot ideas or inversions of hot air by Mr. Menzel or anything else, but these kind of things they do get very worried about. And these statements are anent that type of UFO. And I want to know what it's all about, that's all. And I'm simply presenting here nothing else but a number of statements that have been published.
Ben Esquith? I would like to bring up something that perhaps Ivan remembers hearing about, is something also about a weird story that people should have gotten worried about, and which they did, and which turned out to be very frightening when it finally came out, is that at the time that Einstein wrote his famous letter to President Roosevelt about the possibility of making an atomic bomb, there was a sentence in it that turned out to be very prophetic. It said, "Other countries may be working on this right now." And then, I think, right around that time, there were reports coming out of a German factory and laboratory off the coast, on the coast of Norway, that I think British intelligence had that something funny was going on.
Deuterium.
Lots of stuff came in and nothing came out, and they thought possibly it was a new kind of aircraft fuel.
Yeah.
But they weren't sure about it, so they sent a commando team down there, and they blew up the factory.
Heavy water.
But they found out the Germans were working on deuterium.
Yeah.
And they actually had very cogent plans for making atomic bombs. I mean, this is a wild story, but it turned out to be true.
Exactly.
Absolutely true. And the Germans made the big mistake of thinking that they couldn't use anything but deuterium as a moderator, so they didn't get the atom bomb.
Yeah, but the point was they were thinking.
They were thinking.
I mean, they may have been subsequently, as afterthought, we realized that uranium was the right way to do it, and they were off. But they were thinking about it, and they actually had a plant in a laboratory, which was a fantastic thing to conceive, when all we had was a letter from Einstein.
Right.
It's a very penetrating article also that we haven't mentioned that's very pertinent tonight. It's an article called Robert Goddard, Space Pioneer, and it's written by Dr. G. Edward Pendray, who is, among other things, a consultant to the Committee on Astronautics and Space Exploration for the House of Representatives. And there are one or two sentences I would like to read, I think are really startling. He talks about it, about Goddard, who tried to interest the armed forces in the potential of rockets in 1940, that he got a polite brush off, which cost us an unchallenged lead in rockets and satellites today. And then later on in the article, it goes on to state that in May 1945, only 3 months before Goddard's death,
Captured German rocket experts were asked by U.S. Army specialists about the V-2s that rained death on London in the last month of World War II. To the American surprise, a member of the German group replied, quote, "You have the man in your country who knows all about rockets and from whom we got all our ideas, Robert H. Goddard," unquote. This is a fantastic idea about the fact that V-2 technology stemmed straight from an American who, at the same time that the V-2 specialists were building rockets and going ahead with these amazing...
Exactly.
...amazing plans was being brushed off by our own army. This is in the September issue, right?
Yes, the same issue as the other.
The same issue as Ivan's article and Blessed.
One could argue about it.
John, may I add that we do have some fiction in that too. I mean, I hope nobody gets the idea that we have turned into an article magazine. We have a lot of very good fiction.
One very good novelette by Damon Knight.
That I can't begin to. I agree completely with you.
Jim Run, go ahead, Ivan, I'm sorry. Did you want to add something first?
Well, just a little scrib in there that what Ben read a moment ago, I think that all people, and particularly my good friend Lester Del Rey, should think over that time and time again you get professionals who know about a certain amount about something saying, well, that's it, we got the bottle full of water to the top, and we can't spend our time looking for the water that won't get in the bottle. I've seen it in my speciality, zoology, over and over again. The coelacanth fish, impossible. They've been dead for 60 million years. I have two clippings for the same man. I keep on repeating this. 10 years later, he comes out AP again and says, we always expected to catch one of these fish because it is, after all, a shallow water fish. It's not as a... What's it got to do with it? Let's be not completely open-minded, because then you do go fluey. But let's realize that some people can steal a march on us occasionally. Thoughts and ideas, they progress. And sometimes they can take a big jump on you. And you don't realize, you wake up one day and you get a V2 in your head. I saw that happen over in London. Sorry, John, I've
been... No, before we get back with Jim Runyon, we have a couple of telegrams. Do you want to read those first, Ben?
Well, this is from Hackettstown, New Jersey. It's addressed to Ivan Sanderson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is that a personal telegram?
It doesn't seem to be. What about the beryllium sale?
No, that's a personal telegram. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that, Ivan. It was lying on the table. Take the other telegram.
This one is from New York City, addressed to Long John. Try and land one of your flying saucers in Kansas. Signed, O.L. Comstock. That's the telegram. Try and land one of your flying saucers in Kansas. Obviously, they think we're going to try and invade Kansas.
And they think you're in Nebraska?
Well, I don't know. All right, next one.
No, wait a second. Kansas is a dry state.
he mentioned that they had alcohol in the fuel. That's what it is. Got the thing.
This is from Flushing, New York. Long John. And the person wishes their name be withheld. Former British pilot confessed letter to Malik was hoax.
Yes, I know that. I had that in a recent newscast that it's been proven to be a hoax.
Well, we've been sort of, disregarding one member of the panel tonight, and I would like to ask Mr. Zavalishin.
Oh, you're great, Ben. You're great.
Because I'm really a Russian.
Yeah.
Is that the truth? The FBI is listening. I'm only kidding.
You want to know something? I guess I... I better not say.
Well,
no, go ahead. No, I won't say. Go ahead.
If you can kid about anything that seriously, though, I don't know whether to believe you or not.
That's the attitude I used to get, too. I would like to ask him... especially since he was a former Russian army officer and he was a prisoner of war in Nazi Germany, if I wonder if Jim Runyon would do this for me. And if Mr. Zavalishin ever did see any of these alleged A-7 ships that look so much and perform so much what we hear flying saucers to be, could you do that?
Вы когда-нибудь видели этого немецкого
предмет. Так называемое... так называемого... Эйфетан счет. Нет. Никогда не нет.
I understood that.
Maybe I didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. Yet?
Well, he has a rather incredulous look about the whole thing anyway.
He says no. Uh-huh. Did he see any developments either in Russia or in Germany of advanced rocket development?
No. Ракетное развитие.
Да.
Вы когда-нибудь в Германии видели?
Ракетное развитие?
Да.
В Германии?
Угу. Когда вы были в Германии? Вы сами видели?
No.
No, he has not. In fact, his, I believe, probably his only experience with this type of thing in general has been in meeting people from the Soviet Union who had... contribution.
He himself has never seen any of
these. No, he has not.
Does he know of any either, are there any Russian or German experts he's spoken to who did report some of these things, besides the ones he mentioned previously?
За исключением, за исключением этих примеров, которые вы дали нам,
да,
вы знаете об другом человеке, например, который сказал вам что-то об этом?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You have?
Yeah, I have, yes.
Will he tell us about it?
Будьте добры рассказывать мне.
Это относительно ракет.
Да. It's concerning rockets.
In Germany, what assistance Russian movie director Журавлев, мистер Журавлев, together with Циолковский, works movie picture Cosmic Race. And after war, assistant Mr. Журавлев was by Soviet Russian technical film. Excuse me, please. Переведите, пожалуйста. Он снимал эти секретные снимки вот с заводов V1 and V2.
He took these secrets.
Jim. Thank you very much, Jim. Go ahead.
He was able to take these secret items concerning the V1 and the V2 rockets. So he actually was quite a specialist as far as really knowing what the situation was. Yeah.
Скажите, заводы, где эти делали вещи, они были разрушены. Но всю эту картину, значит, он, так сказать, кинокамерой воспроизвел. Но это были секретные, значит, так сказать, снимки, которые большевики делали. Я с ним имел как раз беседу об этом.
The factories and so forth in which this, these were being developed were destroyed in the process of the war. But the secret plans and photos and so forth were available.
Yes.
And after Журавлев,
assistant Mr. Журавлев,
Mr. Журавлев, managed to get hold of these photographs, well, you talked with him then.
Yes. Assistant Mr. Журавлев worked together with Циолковский.
И скажите, что он мог сравнить то, что, так сказать, делали ученики и последователи Циолковского, с тем, что он уже сам снимал у немцев. Вот что это самое главное.
Ага.
Вот переведите.
Assistant Mr. Juralkov actually worked with Tchaikovsky, and he is able, because of the availability of these photographs, is able to compare what reality is to him from them with the followers of Tchaikovsky.
So from his extensive work filming, making these technical films about the V-2, does he have any sort of ideas about how far advanced the Germans could have gotten to an A-7 ship, one that Ivan described in his article? Does he have any ideas? I mean, I realize he said he never saw one, but does he think they could possibly have had one?
Из этих материалов, которые ассистент Журавлёв имел, да, вы думаете, что у него была мысль о чем мы да, достижении немцев. Вот по поводу A7 сейчас, да?
Нет. Mm-hmm. Но он, значит, сказал вот то же самое, что примерно говорил Грин, что практический опыт немцев и фантазия русских, она вот именно их сочетание может дать совершенно новые открытия. New Discovery. Вот это вы переведите, пожалуйста.
Посмотрите.
Что вот это то, что немцы достигли с этим
Fall War.
И вот русская фантазия, соединение этих вещей позволит русским продвинуться вперед. Вот этот союз немецких и русских ученых.
Jim? I'm not quite sure about this. I think he's saying that...
But do you want to let him repeat it in a different way? Do you want to tell him to repeat it again for you? And maybe... Because very frankly, I'm at a loss. For a moment, I thought we had the Mystic Barber with us. I don't understand it at all, I'm sorry to say. Want to try it again, Jim?
That's Mrs. Tuck. Вот те достижения, что были у немцев, плюс то, что задумали русские в будущем, дадут новые открытия для русской науки. Understand?
Yes, the achievements that the Germans had at the time can actually be compared with the earlier almost fantastic concepts that many Russians had, and that actually these achievements have given a great deal to the Russians in their development.
Yeah, but does he think that it was possible? Oh, I'm sorry. But does he think that it was possible that from what he knows of what was going on in Germany at the end of the war, that a circular type of rocket-propelled plane could have been developed.
Из этого сведения, которое вы знаете, вы думаете, что было возможно, что круглый тип самолета в будущем, как сказать, будет развитым, да?
Скажите, что
из этого сведения?
Не только из этого сведения, но сами большевики, я сейчас, три источника у них есть, три магазина, говорят, что именно в будущем это возможно.
He knows of three different magazines that say yes, they very definitely felt that this was possible from the information that was
given. Ivan, may I ask another question? Does he know anything about back to this UFO sightings in Russia?
Mm-hmm.
Had there been any reports of ghost planes or mysterious things in the sky that he knew of before he was captured and went to Germany?
Mm-hmm.
Or afterwards, for that matter? I mean, have they a thing going on over there? Have they had a thing going on over there like we have had here?
Mm-hmm.
Either before the war or after, that there are mysterious things in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, isn't that or a sky?
Can you get me a little closer, Jim, please, so they can hear? Thank you.
Well, когда вы были в Советском Союзе, это перед тем, как вы приехал в Германию, да?
Да-да.
Вы когда-нибудь слышал или слышал о людях, которые видели эти предметы? Так называемые летающие предметы.
Скажите, до войны не слышал. После войны не только слышал, но и читал.
Mm-hmm. Before the war, no, he had not heard of it. After the war, not only has he heard much about it, but also has read a great deal about it.
Well, in other words, they have had the same kind of sightings, as we call them over here, of unknown objects in the sky, huh?
Yes,
right, Jim?
Yes, after the war. Or at least he knows of people who have seen or heard of them after
the war. Have they had any contact?
Jim, just a minute. Но советская пропаганда эти слухи высмеивала.
Soviet propaganda actually is laughing at these rumors.
But they're still occurring in Russia. I mean, in communist-controlled territory.
Yeah.
They're still cropping up, and they get published sometimes.
Yeah, yes.
Uh-huh. And, any kind of description of them? I mean, are they just mysterious things seen in the sky? Any contact? I mean, you don't probably understand this strange jargon that's grown up. And it's been, I mean, has...
No, especially, о людях, которые, как у нас, все Америки, как говорили после войны, что они имели контакты. С этими предметами.
Был описан один такой случай.
It's been written at least one of these cases, yeah.
First of Lenin actually talked to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. They speak high German?
Ah, yes.
What language do they speak when they're
Lenin?
Скажите, что...
На каком языке они говорили?
На каком языке?
Да.
Вот об этом это было этот случай был описан в журнале «Наука и жизнь», но о языке не говорит.
Ага.
И считается, что это, ну, слух, так сказать, вздор, что ли, ну.
Well, it said, of course, it's actually only a rumor, but he said it was written in как это было
в журнале «Наука и жизнь».
The Journal of scientific life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a count. But there was not verbal contact.
Jim, just a minute. Но этот журнал говорил, что это неправда, он тру, что это
In spite of the fact that the
journal
published the story, they deny the truth of it.
Вот скажи... picture a little remember movie Miracle in Milan.
Ага.
Вот вы расскажите, что там эти староверы уже собирали свои вещи, чтобы их на этом круглом предмете взяли на третье небо живьем.
Ага. He said that the old believers in Russia who had seen these objects and so forth packed up their stuff. In order, well, they feel that this is out of outer space, and they had packed up their stuff to
To leave?
Yeah.
You mean to go to other planets or leave Russia?
No, other planets.
To the other planets, yeah.
As a planet without collective farms.
What happened to...
He just stepped down, though.
Fine.
I got a question here, John.
Ivan?
May I ask, which one of our friends here has been asking me, and I'd like... this is probably directed at Lester. He probably will know more about it. There have been reports, and I've read them, of when the Germans were experimenting with the V-2, that they picked an inhabited island in the Baltic, which was exactly the same distance from Peenemünde that London is. I don't quite figure that out geographically, but still, I have heard this story, and that they, to see if the V-2 worked, they fired this rocket at this Baltic island, off the coast of one of the Baltic states, and it went off duly and made a large hole in the ground. Fortunately, it did not kill many people. I'd like to ask if you've ever heard of that one. I've heard of it several times.
I have heard of it, but I have also heard it denied. And I do know that they fired some of their rockets from Poland into the Baltic. So it may have landed somewhere about halfway between Peenemünde and Poland, and somebody decided that that's what they were doing. I think that's mostly a propaganda story, though.
Yeah, it sounds like it. If it was, it would be interesting to know who gave the instructions to do that, the army or the civilian person who was supposed to be in charge of rocket experiments, wouldn't it?
I think that they were far more interested in finding out what it would do than they were in killing anybody with it right then. And also, there would be too much danger that somebody might live through it and come out and spread the story afterwards in a case like that.
Sounds pretty much like it. That was passed to me by a friend of ours here at the station. I'm glad to get your opinion on it. Mm-hmm. May I go back to the profundities of where we're trying to get at? We've got a little information this evening. I still want to find out, basically, where these continuing stories come from. Has anybody got any further ideas?
I suspect that some of them are a hangover from the days when the Germans were handing out deliberate propaganda stories in advance of the V-2 in order to try to frighten people even more. I think that some of that may have still lasted.
That's a very good point, Lester. It's one that I thought of, too. I remember during the war, I was in a fairly secured position, heard a certain amount of what was going on, and I remember when the buzz bomb started landing on London, I was with my then boss, ultimately superior boss, and I asked him, "Why, this is a pretty bad show." He said, "Oh, it's much worse to come. The next thing we believe is coming is about the size of a house." Well, sure enough, it arrived in the form of the V-2. And I happened to see him. He'd then been transferred, and so had I. And we met again before the end of the war, and another country, and I said to him, "Well, what's coming next?" And he said, "Oh, this is going to be awful." He said, "This, we understand the next thing is going to go down with a whoosh." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "This thing is going to be even larger, and it's going to be properly guided this time." Now, if you look into this article we've been talking about this evening, quotes from, again, I think on this particular occasion, Jim Mosley, that his alleged German officer, von Rittner, he keeps on talking about guiding these planes by, I don't know what the exact term he uses, but he was getting it at the directional Hertzian wave.
Well, those Hertzian waves, of course, would be nothing but radio waves. Yeah, that's an elaborate way of saying something.
Exactly.
Simple.
In other words, radio
old-fashioned. old-fashioned.
That's right.
Radio control.
Now, am I right?
They have much better systems.
I know. But I mean, something else that's...
Even then, they had more reliable systems, because after all, those things can be jammed. And I don't think that they might have been trying to find a jam-free method, but I don't think they
were. Well, an inertial guidance system is self-contained, and once it starts, nothing will interfere with it.
Did they not use the V-2 a cone?
I don't know. Weren't the V-2s radio controlled?
No, the V-2s, I believe some of them were radio controlled on the way up, but they had to take over by themselves after that. And I think the ones that were sent on London were sent all the way on their own. All they did there was to send them up with the idea that after they aimed them first.
Yeah.
They were not sent straight up as the modern rocket is. They were rotated in such a way that they would be aimed.
Yeah.
And they took off at a specified angle. And when they reached a certain speed or height, I don't know which it worked on, they were designed to tilt.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to take care of. From there on, the controls were all up to the normal trajectory.
Uh-huh.
And that apparently is the way it was done.
Another thing I stumbled across when I was reading all this stuff was that they had a cone, radio cone. In other words, they're projecting on a beam from to the right and from the left. And let's make it simple to imagine it two-dimensionally up, and that the rockets were fired up, and if they went too much to the right, they would hit a directional beam, which would trigger something to push them back into the center, and then if they went too far to the left, or actually tri-dimensionally in any direction, they'd be pushed back into this cone until they were free at the top. And then after that, they were on their own, and they tilted over. And
I suspect they would have missed in that way anyway, because they didn't really have enough fuel for very much maneuvering.
The controls nowadays are almost instantaneous. In an inertial guidance system is actually a small computer that goes into the rocket itself. And the thing is aimed at a certain spot, and the computer knows what course, where above the Earth the rocket must arrive at. Because it has to be at a certain spot to start its free fall, to hit that certain spot. And the computer knows where this place is. And also, any variations, the slightest variations in wind pressure or direction come in, the computer will shift the controls to correct for this. So the rocket will always get to that point from which it can fall, go into free fall, and hit that desired spot. And the terrible thing about inertial guidance system is that once they're off, they're on their own. Nothing will ever stop them. In other words, you push a button and it's off. You can't say, come back now. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it.
You can make them blow up.
You can explode them by remote control, which they've done with the Vanguard. The minute Vanguard started veering, they would blow them up from the ground.
Well, it has to be that way, because if there's any possibility of jamming it, you can't use that system. And I don't have no radio system which cannot somewhere or be jammed.
Yeah.
Sure.
You could also fool them, too.
Yeah. You might even be able to reverse them, and that would be very bad.
Now, let me come to one more. Yes,
right. Well, that's the idea when someone suggested, sending by rocket an atom bomb up and hitting the face of the moon. Someone said, well, maybe the moon will start shooting one back.
Well, there are other good reasons for not doing it, but I think they're going to do it anyway.
Well, we can't divulge that information this morning anyway. After all, they recently had the groundbreaking ceremonies on the moon when they started to drill the hole from the light side to the dark side.
You mean there's a dark side? Hasn't somebody found out that the moon rotates?
Please.
Why do you think I'm here?
This is when Howard was there, isn't he?
Oh, the potato farm.
Yeah.
Oh.
He tells about it.
These potatoes are different. They grow on trees.
That's nice. Ivan.
How about the skip plane?
Well, that, was the idea behind the A9A10.
Yes, quite.
The idea that it would go up to a certain level of the atmosphere and then pick up speed, or it would pick up speed before it got there, and then it would dive back in a little and jump. And they hoped to, as a matter of fact, to get almost 3,000 miles range doing that.
I understand that from another article that I read also in a British magazine that the Russians have developed a sort of prototype which will do a little skipping. It goes up far enough, and it can be manned, and it takes very much less fuel than our great big rockets, and it can do, in other words, if we just concentrate on that, we could do, we'd have to do a little less in our rocketry.
Oberth suggested that quite a long time ago.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, Willy Ley also gave a fair amount of description in his missiles, rocket missiles and space travel to that. It's quite an interesting concept.
In the second edition, at least, he did.
The one I have. I haven't gotten his new one.
Have you heard about that, John? The idea is to get up above the dense atmosphere, get up enough speed, and then swoop down, cut up your engine, and go and bounce off the atmosphere and keep on bouncing.
Operation Grasshopper.
Yeah, much the same way as give a flat rock close to
the exactly like a flying saucer.
But it doesn't have to be lenticular in shape.
No, it doesn't have to be, no. Not at all, but I mean...
The X-15 is not lenticular. It has a more or less conventional shape.
I mean,
you look at it, you can vaguely imagine it looks like an airplane.
But are there any engineers at this table? Were you near?
That would ruin the conversation.
No, it sure would.
No, but...
I'm a machinist, if that'll do you any good.
Well, that's... I want to ask a very simple question. About this whole business of the possibility of a lenticular form plane, there's one thing that puzzles me very much. It is perfectly true that if you just throw a coin any old way, it'll go so far. But if you take it in your finger and throw it so the flat surface is horizontal, to make it oversimple, it'll go further.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the object itself is spinning. Now, what is actually the effect, or what would be the effect of having this flange revolving and the main body not being itself skipped or thrown into a twist?
Well, if that thing were designed with proper aerodynamic shape, there would be, after all, the normal system of the variations in pressure between the top and the bottom with movement. In other words, it would have the normal lift at the top and pressure at the bottom, but because of its airfoil shape at the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you spin it, obviously it is carrying a larger surface layer of air with it, and it might have some extra lift from that, just as it would in moving. In other words, it's moving round and around instead of forward.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the most efficient way of gaining lift, and I think that that's why it works fine in toys, and they haven't used it too much in other things. Well, it has been tried.
You know, I'm very worried about something. Many years ago, I would say about 1926 or 27, there was a very wonderful picture called Shape of Things to Come, was by H.G. Wells, wasn't it? Well, this wasn't that. It had that wonderful Swedish actor in it. L. Brendel. Do you remember him, or were you too young for
that?
Oh,
you aren't thinking of, let's see, what is it, Metropolis?
No, not Metropolis. It was another picture about the same time. And, delightful. He dropped into the world of the future. And he was taken around by this couple. And I remember one amusing incident. They were walking along about the 16th upper level in this wonderful city, you know, where they had streets up at the top. And
it was Raymond Massey, wasn't it?
It could have been.
Yeah, Raymond Massey was the...
The young man of the future.
The young man of the future. Yeah. He was also the father of the older man. The Shape of Things to Come.
Brendel wasn't that film.
And L. Brendel was there, and he kept on saying, "Oh, give me the good old days." And they walked along. They thought
it wasn't L. Brendel.
No,
it was the
it
English
was.
Actor.
Now, wait a minute. They saw with this one. They saw a slot machine, a night deposit bank.
That was the Metropolis.
Was it?
Yeah. That's Metropolis.
You watched this
very old
young couple come along. And they put some money in a thing, and then the thing opened, a little baby came out, and he said, "Oh, give me the good old days." And at the same time, in that picture, there were planes shaped just like little Piper Cubs. And there were traffic cops and sort of balloons, and on these cross sections of the street, he'd hold up his hand, and all these little planes would stop and hover. And they were made, if you can follow me, like a cross, you see, with a fuselage and two wings and a tail. And there was a hole in each wing, and there was a hole in the middle of the tail. And there were propellers stationary in those holes in each wing and on the tail. It made a triangle, see? And they had a propeller in the front, so they went forward. When they were told to stop by the cop, they cut off the front propeller, and they turned on these three propellers in the holes in the wing, and the plane remained just hovering. Right? Very nice concept, science fiction concept.
It's right from a science fiction story illustrated by Frank R. Poe.
Well, all right. Now, I've asked many engineers, I was rather interested in that, and I said, "Why doesn't that work?" They said, "It's impossible." And I sat in a restaurant in Washington at the beginning of the war, and it was explained to me, you know, poor little boy, which indeed I was, because I know nothing about engineering, how it is impossible for such a thing to work. Because, so. Now the darn thing is working.
Of course it's working.
Well, the bumblebee can't fly either.
Well, wait a minute. When they told you this, was the helicopter working at the time?
Oh, sure.
It was.
Oh, yes, it is.
Well, then I don't understand how. Well, there's another story that Willie Lay tells. He was out at one of these test ranges where they, you know, were going boom, boom, boom with a big gun.
Yeah.
And they were talking about exceeding the speed of sound, going to Mach 2 or something like that. And they said, "No, it's absolutely impossible. A solid object cannot go through the air at that speed." And he looked at one of these shells going off at Mach 3.
Professor. The famous story is that you can't exceed the speed of sound, you know, and people have been shooting off pistols and rifles and...
Yeah, all these things.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you fellas are doing a lot of talking around here. This craft that you've drawn a little outline of as far as you've been talking about, Ivan, has been used on the planet Clarion for a long time.
Where is the planet Clarion?
Well, in our solar system. It's behind the moon.
It's behind the moon. I see.
It's
behind the moon? How far behind the moon? I want to find it so big it's
seen. I can't divulge that information this morning.
It's behind the dark side of the moon.
That's
right. Oh, astronomy, what you've got to learn yet.
Well, you see, this goes round and round. First of all, a science fiction writer produces such an idea. Then they make a movie of it. Then we are told categorically by engineers that the principle will not work. And then everybody says it will work. Why haven't they got it? Or has they got it? There is your way to stand stationary in the air and get rid of all these stupid veins that you have flashing around on the top. And egg beaters and so on. Oh, wonderful, I know. But no, I'm not any kind of aeronautical engineer. Why don't they make something like that?
They do make something like that, or very close to that. The only trouble with it is that it takes a little more power than a straight helicopter does now. If they get a little more powerful engines, it'll be very easy to do.
Oh, that's the
point. It's a little inefficient still.
I see. It's just a question of...
Well, you don't have very large airfoils there spinning.
Mm-hmm.
And you still have to push against those wings. In straightforward flight, it should work very well, as a matter of fact. It might have a little more wind, air drag, but it should work that way.
You can close those holes off with the propellers in. I suppose the real difficulty is it's how to fit the propeller in, isn't it?
Well, you've got that.
The axle goes up and down.
You remember, if you can't have too large a windmill in there.
No, you cannot. Am I right in saying that the faster the thing goes, the more lift it gets or not?
Well, depending on its shape, up to a certain speed. Remember, at Mach 1 and so on, some of the standard airfoils begin to lose their lift. But up until that point, they gain lift with speed.
Oh, you know what I'm working around to, don't you? I'm still coming back to my... my engineer's alleged design of this.
I know, and I've got one of your questions that I'm going to answer before this program's over, so help me.
Well, shoot.
And you said, categorically, will somebody please accept or deny the possibility that the Germans were working on this?
Mm-hmm.
From all the evidence, having taken the people on one side who say that they were, and who somehow or other were not connected very intimately with the project, at least in the head of the project, and on the other side, having taken the opinion of the people who were connected to the head of the project, such as von Braun and so on, I categorically deny that the Germans were working on these things.
Has anybody ever asked von Braun? Or Urban?
He's been asked just about everything by now.
Yeah, but the point is that...
he also reads these articles.
There's a very fine book called The Last Days of Hitler. And in it, there's a certain... You know, you tend to think of Germany as this fantastically efficient, monolithic state. And in The Last Days of Hitler, by Trevor Roper, he points out that during the last 2 years of the war, Germany had something like 415 separate intelligence services. And they finally decided this was highly inefficient. They were going to put it under one man. So they organized all the German intelligence services, and they put it under one man, who turned out to be Admiral Canaris, who had been a British spy for the last 10 years. I mean, so it's a fantastically efficient system. It's quite possible that German scientists were working on something, as it happened in the United States, and the guy around the corner was working on something else and no one knew about it.
In fact, it would be more possible in a highly departmentalized and highly over-organized German setup than it would be even here.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fantastic bureaucracy. Yeah. Like, in the height of the war, there were 14 factories that were still producing chocolate in Germany.
Well, you know, there's an even better story about the Germans in